Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Força Armada assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
I want to be nasty. Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
Aaj jo partiya yahan shor macha rahi hai.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país. Nada. Absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome to Season 3 of PALcast, the podcast of the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or PAL. I'm Fabio De Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. PAL is an academic network dedicated to understanding how rising autocrats employ the law to consolidate power, sideline political opponents, and govern without constraints, and what has been done to resist those moves, if anything at all. For more information about the project, visit autocratic-legalism.net. My guest today is Raquel Pimenta. Raquel is a law professor at FGV Direito São Paulo, or the FGV Law School in São Paulo, which has been the primary site of PAL research in Brazil. Their team, which Raquel helped lead, has just produced the forthcoming edited book on Bolsonaro's rule and its relationship with the law, which comprises 13 chapters and involved 22 contributors. We already had the chance to hear about one of the main theses in that book when I brought onto the show the FGV Law School Dean, Oscar Villena, in our very first season. Villena and his fellow co-authors argued that the Brazilian political system, which is highly fragmented, made it extremely difficult for Bolsonaro to pass major reforms in constitutional or statutory law that he could build upon to conduct the country through an autocratic shift. But that did not fully neutralize Bolsonaro, nor did it keep him from using law to challenge democracy. Rather, it made him resort to a set of tactics within existing laws, which the authors call authoritarian infralegalism. This includes abuses of executive prerogatives and discretion, such as the power to issue executive orders and appoint heads of agencies, in combination with smear campaigns against accountability institutions, including the Supreme Court, to try to force them to bend to his will. In this episode, Raquel and I talk about the work she did to organize the Brazilian leg of the PAL project, which can be inspirational to many of you listeners in case you want to do something similar in your institution or country. We also touch briefly on the idea of authoritarian infralegalism and the contribution it provides to scholarship on law and democratic backsliding. But we spend most of the time exploring Raquel's own contribution to such scholarship, which was featured in the special issue we published in the World Comparative Law Journal. Her article, co-authored with FGV professor Marta Machado, provides another reason why Bolsonaro could cause so much damage to Brazilian democracy without needing to change laws. Their argument revolves around the existence of zones of authoritarianism within Brazil's incomplete rule of law, which predated Bolsonaro's rise to power. Bolsonaro, rather than constructing entirely new authoritarian structures, simply expanded upon those pre-existing zones to govern as he saw fit. In the interview, Raquel provides a detailed account of this argument, and we discuss its implications for the study of law and democratic backsliding. We finish with a discussion about Bolsonaro's defeat and what the reconstruction of Brazilian institutions has been like after him. Here's the interview. Raquel Pimenta, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Fabio. I'm a big listener of your podcast.
I've known you for quite a few years now, and I remember when we first met, you were this rising scholar specializing in corruption and anti-corruption issues, which were and remain very hot issues in Brazil. And I was seen as a legal profession scholar. And here we are studying and discussing about autocratic legalism. What made you shift from corruption and anti-corruption to issues of law, democracy, and democratic backsliding?
So I still consider myself to be part of the large corruption studies field. There's a famous paper that asks, what is the opposite of corruption, by Bo Rothstein? And people may disagree on the answer. For me, the opposite of corruption is accountability. And accountability can take many forms, and it is a somewhat umbrella concept. However, its core means to keep checks on powerful actors. And for me, it was clear that the phenomenon of democratic backsliding was a larger phenomenon of concentrating power and precisely loosening accountability mechanisms in all sorts of ways. So I felt drawn to this agenda coming from this background of corruption and anti-corruption.
And I assume that the election of Jair Bolsonaro was also helpful in drawing you to this field of studies.
Absolutely. I think it's a long tradition in social legal studies to discuss if we're doing purely scholarly work or activism. And I personally was never an activist in the topics I study, but this project and the question of democratic backsliding had a deep sense of purpose, and along with it, a deep sense of responsibility. Brazil was going through, as you mentioned, a delicate time. And what we could offer, or at least what I could offer, was my training and my analytical skills to try to make sense of what was happening. So it was an engagement, but through this academic analytical skills. And of course, this nurtured, at least for me, a deep sense of responsibility, because although it's impossible to fully separate our experiences from our scholarly work, I wanted to keep a rigorous analysis. A question that was always in the back of my mind is this authoritarian or is this just bad policy? And sometimes the answer is not so straightforward. And going in this project of democratic backsliding during the Bolsonaro years, I had this sense of purpose and also of really responsibilities associated with it.
I was not planning to dive so deep into substantive issues yet. But this distinction that you felt you needed to make between bad policy and attacks on democracy is something that I find extremely important, and I don't think that the literature on autocratic legalism or law and democratic backsliding properly equips us to deal with, because the focus in the literature tends to be on high-level governance structures, like separation of powers or accountability mechanisms, and how those are being destroyed through law, rather than sectoral public policymaking. What links do you see between these two domains of sectoral public policymaking and democratic backsliding, and when can we say that what's happening in a single or in multiple policy areas amounts to an erosion of democracy at large?
If we take democracy as purely the expression of electoral votes, then maybe none of this matters, right? If you take this thin description of democracy as just as to be able to vote, then, well, looking at all these policy domains, for those people, it will not matter at all. However, there are a number of studies that connect democracy to a more thick description in which democracy is not only vertical accountability, but also the ability to promote rights, and many of those through public policies. So I think bridging this gap between the meanings of democracy and public policies is an important task, which appeared to us somewhat inductively, but I think it's a big contribution that we are making in this field. Also, because it will speak to the next step of the problem, right? You can have authoritarian governments that do not stay in power, as it has been the case with Bolsonaro. And if we're looking to a thin description of democracy, this wouldn't matter, right? So he's out. It's done. When we look at the legacies of the policies as part of this authoritarian trend, then we have a much larger problem in our hands. because the Bolsonaro years create new path dependencies for the next government and the next ones, right? So, so I think this connection between what the government does, the policies they implement, and what we think democracy is very important, even if we're talking about a process of democratic decline that is over or that has been avoided.
And I'm sure we'll get back to that. But I have some preliminary questions about the organizational infrastructure that is behind or underneath the work that you did and the work that your team did. Because in addition to your role as an investigator in this project and all the intellectual contribution that you provided to the project, you also have been one of the main organizers of it. The success of Brazilian Power Research owes a lot to your hard work. And one of my goals here on the podcast is to share some of this backstage experience with listeners, because I think they want to know, or they should know, how we do what we do and what it takes to design and implement a project like ours, especially in case they want to do something similar in their institutions or countries. Can you share details of the approach that you took in the process that you put in place to structure the Brazilian leg of the PAL project?
The Brazilian leg of the project already started deeply international, because many of the scholars and researchers that are involved in the Brazilian initiative, they also circulate abroad. So we started realizing that the processes we were seeing in real time during the rise of Bolsonaro to power was part of a much larger trend of democratic backsliding. And this has to do a lot with the meetings online society and the online society association and this concept that was being discussed at the time, the paper by Kim Shapley on autocratic legalism. So one of the important things that I had in mind, or that animated me throughout this process, was while discussing the specificity of the Brazilian case, we were also building a larger area of studies. Now, in terms of organizations, it is a large endeavor, because the approach we took as we were looking at things while they were still unfolding was to approach the experts, the legal experts in a number of fields, and ask them what was happening in their specific areas. So we asked constitutional lawyers, we asked criminal lawyers, we asked public policy specialists, admin lawyers. So in this sense, as we were just trying to figure out and map what was happening, we were building what we have called this bottom-up process, or this inductive approach to the Brazilian experience on law and democratic backsliding. But also, we ended up having a big engagement of our larger community, of our students, especially our master's and PhD students, that, well, they were living the same context as we were, and they were also trying to specialize in one of the two or many of the topics we are all specialists. So one of the great surprises for me of this project was not only the engagement of big names and big law professors or social scientists, but also the students that at times revised or provided comments for the papers of these scholars, and also develop their own ideas. So we called it, in the end, a research-based learning experience, because it was very much based on they looking at the research that was being conducted and positioning themselves in front of them. So I think in terms of the organization, I would say not only it's a lot of work, but it was very fulfilling to see, to be able to reach the both the professors and the students that were interested in democratic decline in general.
And we actually have here on the show a testament to what Raquel has called a research-based learning experience. On episode 13, I interviewed Sofia Rolim, who was then a master's student at FGV. And she talks very openly about how her engagement with the concepts and the body of literature associated with autocratic legalism enabled her to make sense of changes in public safety policy and police behavior in Brazil under Bolsonaro. Even if you had a chance to listen to that episode, I highly recommend that you go back to it, this time having in mind how it demonstrates the pedagogic value that the PEL Project had in the lives of students like Sophia. You mentioned a lot of interesting things there about the approach and the process you adopted, Raquel. But what about the outputs? What did this all generate that is more tangible?
In terms of outputs, we have a book coming up this December that unites all of these studies, or these first studies that were conducted throughout these last years. And I guess one of the findings that is actually Oscar Villena's, Rubens, and Ana Laura Barbosa's main findings that is part of this book is that the Bolsonaro methods of democratic decline was unlike many other countries, which it was done through constitutional changes or through high-level legal changes. But the Bolsonaro years were marked by infralegal changes to promote the erosion of democratic institutions. So they show how this authoritarian infralegalism developed through an abusive use of discretion of the executive on decrees, actions, nomination, and so on and so forth. And it is interesting to see how many of the studies in the book actually confirm this idea of a specific method that the Bolsonaro government used in several areas, in several arenas, to advance an authoritarian project. And we still have another book by the students coming up as well. This is coming up next year, March, which then they use these concepts and other concepts to further advance, and they question if it's infralegal authoritarianism, if it's something else in their own arenas. So this is also coming up next semester, both in Portuguese, unfortunately, or fortunately for the Portuguese readers, of course. But we also have a contribution that was recently published in the VRU, the World Comparative Law. We will talk a little bit about that later. But before we move to that, I just wanted to say that this paper on authoritarian infralegalism actually invited many other scholars to a discussion that was maybe once restricted to constitutional lawyers. So I think it helped in a way to open up the debate for different scholars from admin law, economic law, to come into the field and bring their own tools of analysis to it. So in that sense, I think it was an important study for understanding the Brazilian case.
Let me then take the chance to pitch another episode from PELcast's archive, which features precisely Oscar Villena, one of the authors of this chapter on authoritarian infralegalism, where he explains in detail the argument you just summarized. I highly recommend that listeners go back to that episode to fully understand what is at the heart of this thesis about the methods used by Bolsonaro to attack Brazilian democracy and the place that law had in there. You said before that structuring this project became a form of activism that you engaged in when faced with the menace that Bolsonaro represented to Brazilian democracy and the Brazilian Constitution, but that this also brought you a sense of responsibility in which you did not want your policy preferences to contaminate your analysis. In addition to this, what other challenges did you face when trying to make sense of Bolsonaro's term in office and its impact on Brazilian law in real time?
I think as we had the idea for the first part of this project to really produce comprehensive mapping of what was happening in different policies, in different arenas. One challenge was that there was always new events coming up. So we started this project a little bit before the COVID outbreak. And this, for instance, the COVID outbreak was an important factor for courts, especially the Supreme Court, to change its rulings and behaviors on Bolsonaro. So a major fact here, the COVID outbreak, prompted Bolsonaro to adopt a denialist approach to COVID, and then the Supreme Court acts upon it, reverting, controlling, putting limits to some of his actions. So this was the challenge, just bringing maybe one that was huge and out there, but this was a challenge for many of the studies that were looking to the Bolsonaro and to actually distill the analysis and to actually make sense of these facts, understand what is more important, what is less, what is rhetorics matter. And this is very clear in our book. We have contributions that go and say that rhetorics matter, but also how do they actually are implemented and how do they turn into policy? So these were all big challenges to separate facts from analysis, to put them in some order of hierarchy. Anyway, so we also do not claim to offer absolute conclusions with one or two books or even a set of papers. We are offering some explanations that hopefully researchers can use to continue to look at the processes of democratic backsliding and rebuilding in Brazil and elsewhere. So also, I think we came to peace with the fact that this is one part of what needed to be done at this particular time. And I have to say, not only by the group of researchers that were looking at this at FGV Law School, but by many researchers at the time. We were trying to offer at least some guidance to make sense of those times. Also, our bet here is, although these were real-time events and although there were many facts coming up, we had the great advantage of having, you know, this really these people that already had the brains for it to take a look on this act. So it was also we could rely on the fact that they knew their areas. They knew that the Brazilian democracy is a contested process. So it was not only blue skies before Bolsonaro. So that also helped to make sense of these ambivalences.
Let's then talk about one of your papers, the one you published in our special issue in the World Comparative Law Journal, and which is fully available to our English-speaking audience. Why don't you start by giving an overview of your argument there?
So the literature on autocratic legalism or law and democratic decline more generally was focused on many of the experiences that were unfolding in the world, right? So Trump in the United States, Orban in Hungary, and so on and so forth. But at times, they missed an important component of these experiences, which was history. At times, because they were shedding light on what was changing towards more authoritarianism, they paid little attention to what made it possible. So it left room for a sort of idealized version of the past where there were democracies, and then for some reason they were now endangered. So in this paper that we wrote, we wanted to say that these democracies and the Brazilian democracies especially, they are very much contingent to the history and to the past. And while the transition to democracy has brought a new set of institutions and tools and practices and access to rights and policies, there were lingering authoritarian practices. And we call this as zones of authoritarianism. So in this paper, We argue that the process of democratic decline led by the Bolsonaro government not only eroded institutions and democratic practices, but built on and expanded this, what we call these pre-existing zones of authoritarianism that already existed in Brazil's political and economic domains. So we characterize these zones of authoritarianism not as a one institution or rule or a territory, but an entanglement of informal practices, formal rules, and institutions that produce continuously and over time unchecked powers as exceptions to the rule of law inside a democratic country. So the fact that there are zones of authoritarianism and they are maintained throughout a democratic processes, it speaks to the idea that the distinction between liberal and authoritarian regimes is much more complicated and intertwined than usually described in the literature. So we explore in this paper two cases we're trying to understand these zones of authoritarianism, which are police violence and corruption. So in these two cases, corruption and police violence, they are bound together by the central idea of impunity. Not in the same ways, let's be clear. Impunity in police violence is different than impunity in corruption. And we're trying to explore how these different meanings allow for zones of authoritarianism to reproduce themselves.
So tell us more about it.
So in the case of corruption, since redemocratization, scandal after scandal of corruption brought incremental reforms to a lingering sense of impunity. Overall, these reforms created a fragmented and interdependent web of accountability that is responsible for monitoring, investigating, and punishing corrupt acts. The efficacy of these policies, however, was always subject to some contestation. So due to the idea that impunity was still reigning for the last decade, the anti-corruption policy experienced another strategy. A big push driven by a growing reliance on criminal punishment. And the car wash investigations, which you also studied, Fabio, is part of this trend of a big push against impunity, over-reliant on controls through punishment. So the idea of impunity was central to car wash and helped to sustain some of its controversial and at times illegal methods. So to uncover complex corruption schemes and take down politicians and business people, any means were justifiable. So car wash left us a complex legacy. The Brazilian public had to deal with two unwrestling truths. One, the scale of corruption that was uncovered. That is impunity right there. The second, the fact that the legal system, especially criminal law, was so overused. This also represented, in some instances, the use of unchecked powers.
Yes, in my studies, it was very clear that the prosecutors in the Lava Jato case, aided by the media and even by academics, not only committed abuses in their work, but also tried to legitimize those abuses, claiming that existing laws were insufficient and that they had to go above and beyond these laws to save the country from an existential threat.
When it comes to public safety, then we're talking about a different story, but also a story of lingering impunity and lingering powers that are not controlled and are not subject to the rule of law. Brazil has a lengthy history of police violence, which was not completely authored with the 1988 Democratic Constitution. So the abusive use of police force, particularly against the Black and impoverished communities, represents a legacy both from colonial times and from the military dictatorship. So with a culture of impunity that is rooted in the country's refusal to punish human rights violations that are perpetrated by state agents, at least in the recent past. So attempts to promote police reform during democratic period were either insufficient or blocked. And growing violence that is very much a feeling spread out through the Brazilian society has served to legitimize growing the use of police force. So here we can see that we have a democratic country that promotes human rights, but continues to experience police violence and with very little results in terms of its control.
But how did Bolsonaro build upon and expand these zones of authoritarianism that were constituted around corruption and police brutality to get to power and to govern as a non-democratic politician?
Both corruption and police violence were enablers of Bolsonaro's path to power. This is very interesting. They were connected by the extensive use by the then candidate of a moral discourse of zero tolerance and law and order, which mobilized the population's fears and images of internal enemies. He relied on the division between the good citizens and the thugs and the crooks, creating this idealized image of the past where corruption and the crooks didn't have a place. However, once he was in the presidency, Bolsonaro acted towards the expansion of these domains of unchecked powers. His government decreased the efficacy of anti-corruption policies and endorsed the abuse of force by the police. So here, what we are showing in this paper is that those two areas with different stories and different trajectories, they're both served as a leeway for Bolsonaro to implement its authoritarian project.
And I think what you're doing here is very valuable. You know, going back to something you said before, demonstrating that it's not always, and maybe it's never the case that democracy was fully functional and consolidated, and then all of a sudden, there's this authoritarian figure who leads that perfect democracy through a breakdown. It may well be the case that these zones of authoritarianism existed within democracies, which not only compromised the performance of these democracies, but also made it possible for the incoming authoritarian to subvert the system and make democracies backslide. And this is an argument that you bring from what political scientists call transitology, studies of transitions to democracy, where it became very popular, the idea that some countries like Brazil, these countries had made an incomplete transition. They had successfully adopted elections, but they had all these gaps when it comes to other pillars of democracy, namely the rule of law. But while I think there's an important point being made by you here, I also think there's a risk in associating zones of authoritarianism to incomplete transitions, because this might make us reify the divide between young and consolidated democracies and overlook the fact that some of these problems that you point to can also exist in the latter. When I think about the United States, for example, it did not go through recent democratization like Brazil. Quite the opposite. It is often deemed exceptional because of how strong and deep-rooted its democracy supposedly is. But when you look at the U.S. more closely, it doesn't take long to identify many similar zones of authoritarianism. And in fact, there's a paper by Michael McCann and Phyllis Karaman where they look at the Trump years and they reach the same conclusion that you reach in your study of Brazil, that Trump built upon these lingering zones of authoritarianism much more than he started new ones. My question then is, to what extent, when we talk about law and democratic backsliding, is the distinction between transitional and consolidated democracies meaningful?
Right. I think we look at the transition, what we call transitology or studies of democratic transition, also to be mindful that many of the countries in Latin America, this is not the first experience we had with authoritarianism. So also to, if we are making an argument in which we should incorporate history, then we should also incorporate other moments of history that were looking at different problems, of course, of authoritarianism during the military dictatorship is different than what we have seen with Bolsonaro rising through elections. But at the same time, it also left the questions that we were picking up. They were already there in those studies. And when we arrived, I think now the situation is a little different, but when we started this whole project, there was not much attention paid to the fact that all of these studies were already out there. So we had a big experience with trying to consolidate democracy and revert authoritarian experiences. So I think we use these studies not so much to highlight the difference between consolidated and emergent democracies, which I agree were a feature, maybe a feature of these previous studies, but actually to look at the questions and problems that were already mapped by others in the past. So we draw heavily on McKen's dualities to build our paper. So I think we're very much in full agreement with him. We're just maybe building the zones of authoritarianism based on the Brazilian experience. That is, and the military dictatorship is an undeniably important experience for us to understand the Bolsonaro years. Because he said so. It's not even because we are the ones bringing back the military dictatorship. It's just because he and his government and his supporter mobilized these years to try to build on a new platform, right? So I think in the end, zones of authoritarianism are important in Brazil as it is in the US for different reasons and maybe through different literatures, right? But I think the contribution of the paper is to bring history back in.
And that's a contribution that is duly noted. Let's talk about life after Bolsonaro, but let's start with what made it possible for Brazil to get rid of him in the first place. I know, Raquel, that you're involved in another project, the GRAD Project for Global Resistance to Authoritarian Diffusion, a sister initiative of PAL, and that in your contribution to that project, you reached some conclusions that can help us understand why Bolsonaro was defeated in 2022. Tell us more about that.
In the GRAD Project, I have made two contributions. One of the papers with Deborah Maciel, Marta Machado, and Sofia Rolim focuses on the mobilization in defense of democracy that happened in Brazil in August 11th in 2021.
Let's just take a short pause here to provide listeners with some contextual information. On August 11, 2022, in the lead up to the elections, there was a big event that was hosted at the University of São Paulo Law School, where both Raquel and I graduated, where a letter to Brazilians in defense of democracy and the rule of law was publicized. This letter was signed by several different actors, from bankers to university professors to workers to black movement activists to environmentalists. And although a lot was going on at the time in the country politically, the August 11 event became somewhat distinctive, precisely because it had the capacity to attract so many different stakeholders.
The August 11 episode is a turning point in what we call non-institutional opposition against the Bolsonaro government, because it brought a large coalition of economic actors, legal actors, unions, together under the same democratic field, overcoming what would be maybe fragmented agendas of the non-institutional opposition and uniting supporters from a large portion of the political spectrum. This is not an easy, simple task. And so our study aims to describe the actions of the agents and the groups that made this coalition possible. Also, we investigate the different meanings they had for the buzzword democracy, right? So the August 11th episode is an experience that is rare in many parts of the world in the sense of building this large heterogeneous coalition. The August 11th played a decisive role in making the idea of a united democratic front to win over Bolsonaro possible in the streets and then during the presidential race that elected Lula. The other contribution, and here I am interested in the role, the two contributions that I make in the grad project are connected by my growing interest on the role of markets on authoritarianism and resistance. Because as much as we were mentioning on how the first wave of studies did not bring history to the forefront of these studies, another gap is the role of markets and market agents in supporting or opposing those authoritarianisms. We tend to look at courts, at the executive, at to Congress, but we don't look at how economic power is shaped by those experiences or maybe resist those experiences. So in this paper of the August 11th episode, I'm really intrigued and interested in understanding why some actors of the economic elite decided to take part on this broad coalition. And then in the other paper, we're exploring how international pressure over economic players, over economic agents, also helps or not to provide some resistance to the authoritarian policies. If markets are more globalized, then the role of international players can affect domestic policies. But it's not a given. The more important concept here is that international pressure is not, it doesn't mean that it will be successful or not. So we're trying to investigate in which conditions international pressure to economic agents can make a difference or not.
And what has been your conclusion?
First, I have to say that this is a paper I'm writing with my colleague, Mari Shapiro. And the conclusion is that international pressure has to be met by a cohesive group, cohesive domestic group that feels the effects of these pressures and then may act upon it and then may use this international pressure to act differently. So we look at different instances of environmental policies to show that when groups are more dispersed and less cohesive, international pressure will, even if it's really high, we take the example of the Amazon Fund, in which Norway and Germany, after the Bolsonaro government changed the internal rules of a fund destined for conservation and of the Amazon forest, we show how even though donors to the fund were very vocal against the changes that the Bolsonaro government made and halted and stepped back on providing new donations to that fund, this did not have an effect on the policy. The Amazon Fund stayed completely paralyzed throughout the Bolsonaro years. And we show that these international pressure, because of the rules and the governance of the fund, this international pressure was diluted because the funds are used for a number of activities and for a number of players. Well, we take another example on prudential rules for banks, and we show that despite the Bolsonaro government years, the Brazilian Central Bank implemented new green prudential rules. And we show that this has to do with a strong international pressure that favors green prudential rules, and also to the fact that the international pressure is felt by a more or less cohesive group, Brazilian banks, that are already very much accustomed to abiding by strict rules of strict prudential rules, and that want to keep their access to international markets as open as possible.
Let's then talk about what it has been like to rebuild Brazil after Bolsonaro. As a close observer of legal and political developments of the country, you certainly have thoughts about the state of our democracy at this point. Could you share them with the audience?
One thing that we are learning for these past year, or almost a year, is that there are long-lasting consequences, even if we're discussing infralegal methods of authoritarianism. For one, some outcomes are not easily reverted. Think about deforestation, the access to guns, or the death toll of Bolsonaro's denialist COVID policy. This is not easily reversible. But also, the politics of regulation or those sectoral regulation have changed. Certain political and economic actors were strengthened throughout these years, and they are now apt to make more demands and in different ways than in previous governments. So the democratic governance, what we're seeing is that democratic governance is more complex these days. So there is no return to the past. The Bolsonaro government created their own set of past dependencies that will shape our future. And this is why it's so important to take stock of these years and not just say, well, this is done, let's change the conversation. We have to understand what persists. And I think this is one of the challenges of rebuilding Brazil after Bolsonaro. But of course, there's also, in many ways, there are a lot of changes in the policies, in the sectoral policies. I can name a few in my field. We have seen a big push back to transparency as a rule. And I think this is an important outcome after a government that made transparency a much more contested concept. And I think we're seeing the climate agenda really at the forefront of the government, which was not the case in previous years. And I think it's also a result of the Bolsonaro years, because of all the damages to the international reputation that his policies made. So if there is no return to the past, there's also a lot of hope for the future.
Before you go, I need to ask the question that I always ask to our interviewees. What are the three readings or resources that you recommend to listeners who may want to know more about all that we discussed in this episode?
So one of the things that we didn't mention is that this BRU special issue is not about Brazil. It's about a number of different countries. And I think put together, this makes a great reading to read about the Brazilian experience, the South African experience, the Indian experience. I think it really adds to the existing state of the literature. So if I can be, maybe you were expecting something more prosaic, I really would like to recommend the VRU special issue. I think for those that are more interested in anti-corruption, I would recommend the Ross and Taylor's book, Brazilian Politics on Trial, which helps to understand all of these conversations we were having about anti-corruption policies and its efficacy in Brazil. And yeah, I think for the Brazilian audience, I would just say for them to keep a look for what's coming and for those two books.
That was Raquel Pimenta. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
If you like this series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have any feedback to our episodes or to our projects, please drop me a note at fabio.desaiasilva@ou.edu.